Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is my co-host, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Hello.
I am Mark Bigney, and happy Victoria Day, Walker.
Happy Victoria Day.
Or as I celebrate, Journée Nationale des Patriotes, because in Quebec we do not observe Victoria Day.
I call it Terrified Dog Day.
Why do you call it that?
Because dogs hate fireworks, Mark.
That is true. Kingston seems to want to deploy fireworks at any given opportunity.
It's true.
I don't like. Sometimes I hear fireworks, and half the time it's, oh, I guess there was a holiday 2 days ago. But the other half of the time, it's, I have no idea why there are fireworks.
It's because the superstores in the area sell them, so therefore there'll be fireworks.
Okay, this is not so much a practical question. It was not so much a how, it was more of a why. But at any rate, we're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to talk about our feature game, which is Cascadero. So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, you and I got to play a game called Dice Flick. This is designed by Rami Gaber and put out by Pegaspiel Games. And it is a very random dice flicking game. But I want to put it in sort of context.
I think
because I played it out like on a patio, and I think for that setting, it's sort of the perfect sort of setting for it. It's quick and easy to play. You're simply putting it's played inside the bottom of the box. There is sort of a board game insert, you could say, that's in there. That's all these little sort of pockmark holes that creates this grid with a gutter around the outside. And then it has a stand, four stands that attach to the outside of the box. Place a die there, flick it in, create groups of three or more dice, and then you score the pips that are on those dice. There's our pink dice that do special things. They're called blast dice. And they either score all the dice in the row or the column. And then when you score dice, you pull them out and they go back in the bag. You flick two dice a turn and dice flick.
Even by the standards of a silly little dice flicking game, I was disappointed by Dice Flick, to be frank. First of all, I found it much too long. We played it with three, and I sincerely felt that it would have been preferable at half the length that it was. Now, would this exacerbate the randomness? Yes, but it's already super random. Maybe you'll pull dice that could lead to scoring, or maybe you'll pull the dice that score automatically, the aforementioned blast dice, which are as butch as they are overpowered, or you might pull dice that will only serve to set up your opponent for their future turns. And it was to the point that I actually observed that once Chip the Third guttered a die, and I was thinking, actually, that was good because that die wasn't going to score unless it hit the bullseye in the center. And if he just left it on the board for somebody else, well, then they could score because dice get removed as they score. And so the consequences of missing a shot are not only that you don't get to score, but you are handing points to your opponent. So that exacerbates other areas of luck. It's like what your draw, luck of what the pip is going to show up in the board, luck of what might be left for you from the previous turn, etc., etc., etc. And so I felt that as far as silly little dexterity games go, it wasn't playing to its strengths because it was too long, and I didn't think that the scoring was interesting or that the overall gameplay dynamics were particularly good. I agree with you that it seems ideally suited for a sort of patio-type environment because there are no cards to fly away.
Nothing will blow that, so I was going to bring that up after you finished.
Right.
Yeah, because like I said, there's many games that you can play outside, many card games, but I mean, like, for, you know, any wind or anything else, everything's heavy, everything's in the box. It's nice and compact.
Sure. In that context, though, there are lots of games that are made entirely out of Bakelite that are probably more serious. If you don't want to play a more serious game, I suspect, you know, the amount of wind you'd need to topple a game of just taking one somewhat randomly of, say, Animal Upon Animal.
Or Hive.
Exactly. Hive, though, is exactly one of those more serious Bakelite games. My preferred sort of patio, chill environment thing might actually be Hanabi, but I really like Hanabi, so whatever. And while I agree that environmental conditions might make something like Animal Upon Animal not workable, sure. You don't want something frenetic like Paku Paku or whatever, but anyway. Even by the standards that we've identified, I thought the Dice Flick was pretty disappointing. And so I don't know that I'm inclined to play it again.
Dice Flick.
Dice Flick. Walker showed us A Message from the Stars. This is part of a bunch of games that were crowdfunded by Allplay, formerly BoardGameTables.com, which is definitely Walker's favorite name for a board game publishing company. And A Message from the Stars is a team-based or co-op deduction word game thing. Now, there's two games going on simultaneously. One game is trying to give clues so that your partners will match certain letters from a list of six. So far, so standard. On top of that, what you have is layered on a sort of mathematical system whereby some letters are worth a point, some letters turn the valence of the word negative, and some letters double the overall score. So, for example, I give Walker a clue. Walker tells me that the value of this clue that I've given him is -4. Okay, well, I can infer a variety of things from that. I can infer that, first of all, the negative modifier applies. So whatever the negative modifier letter is, it's somewhere in that clue. I can also infer that there were either 4 instances of a +1 letter, or 2 instances of a +1 letter and a multiplier, or a single instance of a +1 letter and then 2 multipliers and the negative value. Anyway, that part, that last part, is joined with a series of notational conceits whereby letters are assigned a difficulty, and you know that there's a certain combinatoric of different difficulties. So you start getting into a situation that some gamers love, and some people enjoy doing in terms of puzzles, which is, okay, this letter is either an A, a B, and an N. If it's an N, it can't be the B, and that means that the negative number can't be the V or the H that we identified before. But if it's the A, then it could still be the B, and the H is in play, and so on and so forth. And you start going down that and using that to inform what clue you want to give. Again, while still ideally gesturing towards what the letter, the actual words that you want your partner to guess.
And it's sort of like a back and forth thing, because not only am I giving words so they can guess a certain word, but I'm also sort of listening to where they're having trouble on letters, and I'm trying to formulate a word that not only gives a clue to another word, but also will inform them on what letters to pick. And then they do the same and give. Then say if it's an alien talking to a bunch of scientists,
right?
So as an alien, I give that a value, and then they come up with a word using the same sort of formula, and then I give a value to it.
The part where you are trying to come up with a clue that satisfies a number of different requirements, that part I thought was cool. It really tests your vocabulary and your ability to be flexible in terms of, well, I'd really like to give this clue, but I really want it to have a B and no V. Okay, combinatorics like that. The part that informs that, the underlying element, namely the note-taking, that process of elimination, the part where you feel like you're studying for a standardized test like the LSAT or the MCAT, that part tends to actually give me a physical headache, and I do not enjoy. I was getting there. I was almost at the point of getting a headache. And I thought it very, very tedious and tiresome and directly contrary to my preferred gaming tastes. The flat word association is so straightforward as to be almost trivial. The using the math to inform your clue is interesting. The calculating the note-taking to winnow down the possible results and all the combinatorics there, I thoroughly disliked.
So there are 3 columns of words. I think there's about 6 words per column.
Yes.
And you get 1 chance at each column because there's only 4 rounds in the game. So we sort of, it doesn't dictate how you play in the rule book, but
it seems obvious that your first 3 clues should be the first 3 columns.
Yeah, so one per column. And then the 4th clue, we've sort of figured out that should be to lock down the last of the letters for the cipher, right? Because there's no way that you would give a clue in the 4th because which column is it going to be for, right? You have no idea.
I could imagine different groups reaching different conclusions, but that is very much what we assumed, yes.
So I push back slightly against the trivial part because you have 1 chance to sort of figure out a word for each column. I know a lot of them are different, but there is a little bit there.
The process of coming up with the solutions, it was just entirely straightforward. Indeed, we're going to be talking later on about a different party game, a different co-op party game about inferences, where indeed you enter these sort of double-think rabbit holes where it's like, do we really? It could mean this other thing. There's this other detail we could use. No, it was like, this clue means Michelangelo, this clue means swamp, this clue means classroom, we're done. And so I really do think it was borderline trivial. It was also troublingly easy. Yeah. I say that I had a great deal of difficulty with the note-taking. I confess that Huey did a lot of the work there in terms of just winnowing down the possibilities. But on our first try out the gate, we achieved an almost perfect score. We were 1 shy of a perfect score. And so I wonder what the horizons are because you claim that there are no difficulty levels.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's the problem I was going to bring up at the end because we played it a second time after the stream and got a perfect score. So I agree with you. The difficulty level is going to be odd. I'm thinking that you can... Because one of the sort of inferences is that the difficult letters, the red letters, it can only be 1 total. So I'm wondering if you just take that hurdle out and have more than 1, that would make it more difficult. Maybe, I don't know. Going to check the rule book again and see if there's a way to make it more difficult. But as it plays right now, it seems as though gamers that are used to these word type association and or ciphers, because this is right up Sidewinder's alley.
Yes. She's
pretty well just, even though you said that Dewey was taking the notes and leading you forward, he was left in the dust and had no idea as she like figured out most of the letters, you know, after the first word. So definitely she enjoyed it. It was right up her alley, like I knew it would. That's why I sort of said, you know, we need to play this because I know you're going to like it.
Right.
So I hope there is a way to make it more difficult.
As I say, it doesn't surprise me that it has an audience, and indeed that audience is Sidewinder. But I felt that what it added when compared to Codenames, Just One, So Clover, you name it, was very much not to my taste. It is literally the kind of one of the kinds of puzzles that I detest that is sometimes instantiated in board games and video games. And so I found it very tiresome from that perspective. But if you do enjoy that kind of puzzle, that kind of series of deductions, then A Message from the Stars might be right up your alley. So there you go.
Message from the Stars. So another game that was sort of tacked on to that crowdfunding thing. So there was Through the Desert, and the two games tacked on was A Message from the Stars, and the last one was Switchbacks. So these two games I did not hold high hopes for because I'm not, because I have this sort of predisposition of games that are tacked on that the publisher and or the designers don't feel they're strong enough to stand on their own. And then I read the rule book for Switchbacks and I came up with a positive thing to say, Mark.
Did you now?
So Mark, the designer of No Thanks, Thorsten Gimler, let's pretend he gets the complete rights to No Thanks back. Mm-hmm. Not that you might have them already. He's a sign he's never going to publish it again. And he lines up sort of his lineage that never again will No Thanks be published. And then he makes an active play to collect all of the existing ones that haven't been sold and ones that have been sold and burns them all. There's no way to get No Thanks. Then I might say, hey, check out this game called Switchbacks. It might be okay.
The key sin that Switchbacks commits, I think, in terms of design is that No Thanks works because the cards are all public. And you don't know for a fact that a given card will enter the game because a small number have been buried. But if it enters the game, then in theory, everyone on the table might get a chance to interact with it in some way. And that drives a lot of the tension. If a 17 comes up and you know that the 17 is strictly advantageous for some other player, that drives the difficult decisions on your part about how to react on that basis. Or if you know that a certain card will become advantageous if you acquire some other card which is not yet advantageous, you start worrying about whether or not you're going to acquire that. If everybody had a private hand of cards, No Thanks wouldn't work. Enter Switchbacks. There's this spatial element which is not particularly interesting. You score a chain if it is the case there are four or more contiguous tiles of ascending or descending number, but you don't know who's going to draw those tiles. Switchbacks.
Yeah, maybe if they were square tiles, then there would be a little more pressure, but they're like hexagons. So well, you can almost link anything that you want.
Well, that would make more opportunities for trivial blocking. It's already almost trivial to block somebody because you might just have pulled the tile that they desperately needed and you just send it off to the other side of the board and no one's the wiser.
Yeah.
And then there's the possibility of just drawing a tile that connects to an already existing chain, in which case, hey, points for nothing. And those are the two prongs of Switchback's scoring. Either trying to set up your own chain, in which case, who knows who's going to draw the tiles that need to come out of the system. Even if they exist in the system, they might have been buried at the outset. Or someone might just draw tiles. The majority of my points in Switchbacks came from just pulling tiles that were already part of completed chains that other people had already completed. Free points. No pressure. No decision-making. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. New from the rule book that Switchbacks was not to my taste. Switchbacks.
Switchbacks.
From All Play.
Finished my game of Mage Knight the board game. And this was a reminder that Mage Knight, despite the fact that it is so different from a lot of the overland fantasy adventures of yore, it has one of the core elements that I don't object to, but I'm very, very bad at. And that is the gut check. The trying to figure out when you're ready to go after the boss. Because in order to satisfy the victory conditions in most Mage Knight scenarios, conquest is one of the most common ones. You have to go and sack a certain number of cities. And all that you know is that it has a whack of enemies. You may know their stats, you may not know their stats leading up to your preparations. But the upshot is that the system is sufficiently complicated that I cannot personally run through an entire combat in my head as to what the immediate consequences are going to be when I'm fighting two or three of these very strong enemies. Even if you're playing co-op, it gets even more difficult to parse out because that increases the volume of enemies that you have to kill. And when you collaboratively assault a city, the enemies are handed out at random. You decide in advance how many each player is going to take, and then they're doled out at random. So it just makes it so that the system is so full of so many variables that I can't immediately process what's going on. So you have to have react on kind of an intuitive, vibey level about when you're ready to go sack a city. I never think I'm ready to do anything. I'm a perpetual man-child. I don't think I'm capable. I don't think I'm able. I don't think I'm good enough, smart enough, and I don't think that people like me. And so there's this prospect of like, oh, here's the city comes up. It's got two white enemies, a gray enemy, and a purple enemy. It's like, oh, I can't touch that. It doesn't matter what level I am in Mage Knight. I never think I'm able to do anything. On a turn, when I look at my hand, and I can look at a dragon, and I know it's one specific set of stats, I'm like, I guess I could maybe... And that's usually as far as I go. This isn't a knock on the game. This is just about me being too conservative. And so the final round of our co-op Blitz Conquest scenario came up. And I said, yeah, we're never going to win, but maybe we'll be able to sack the first lower level city. This is especially true because my partner was on the other side of the map, kind of hemmed in by mountains and forests. And forests are not a good thing to be hemmed in by at night in Mage Knight. So we go and sack the city. We sack the city without taking a single wound and without activating about half the units that we thought we were going to activate. So then we start looking at the other city. It's like, my partner's like, I've only got one hand left. I'm like, okay, so there's no chance that this can happen. Maybe I could go kill what we sacked the second city.
Nice.
And so it was very satisfying. It was definitely a down to the wire victory, but this is just an emphasis that very much like the old style fantasy adventures of yore, it's going to be about when do you think you're ready to force the end game. And I never think I'm ready to force the end game. But sometimes you end up surprising. It was a great sort of climactic finish for Mage Knight, the board game. And it was a great experience. Still one of our perennial favorites in the genre. Pretty dense, but again, it helps to have somebody there that's willing to run all the different adventure sites, what they're called. It's like, okay, well, here's the difference between town and a monastery. Here's the difference between a maze and a labyrinth. Here's the difference.
Ruins and a dungeon.
Exactly. It's like, oh, this doesn't get flipped up yet because it's night. When it comes daytime, it'll be flipped up. When it gets, oh, well, this is a city. Cities, they always get flipped up next week because, you know, they're cities. Oh, rampaging monsters always face up. No. That rampaging monster doesn't go chase you because there's a wall in the way, etc., etc., etc. The core elements, though, I'm always surprised. Every time I teach Mage Knight, the board game, I'm always like, okay, well, here are the core elements. And we're done? Oh, we're done. Okay, time to get started.
Then there's the side cases.
Then there's all the side cases, of course. But if you're helping somebody, especially in a co-op game, you can manage them through it and run them through without too much difficulty.
When they come up, yeah. You don't even have to. Half of them won't even come up, so you can just truck.
Absolutely.
Keep trucking.
So wonderful time. Mage Knight, the board game. Vladik Vatel, 2011. Apparently, they were still publishing board games back then. I thought the board games were invented in 2014, apparently.
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Weird. Lastly for me, we streamed Leviathan Wild. This is designed by Justin Campignan and published by Moon Crab Games. And I'm blown away by how they've tweaked the difficulty level, because this one brought us right to the brink mark. Two people had died. The last person was like, you know, they were touching but not quite crossed over. And the creature went down and we won at the very last second. Great times were had by all. This was like a giant beholder with all these tentacles and had this eye open, eye shut sort of mechanism. So you had to pop it in the eye and it would close, and then you had to do some other things to make it open its eye again, and then you could do damage again. Anyway, great game. Leviathan Wilds, you're jumping all over these giant titans, breaking crystals and trying to uncorrupt them while not trying to get corrupt yourself.
If you lose the game due to corruption, are you then rewarded with a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yikes, we keep it topical.
You showed us Priorities. Priorities is designed by one of my favorite designers, Uncredited. They do great work.
Ah, man, so many games by those guys.
Very prolific, yeah. Published by Clarendon Games. Priorities is kind of within striking distance of Fun Facts, in that what happens is you get these five potential priorities, and the table attempts to guess how an individual will rank them in terms of their own life. And I got to learn that my friends think that I might value checklists over physical contact. And this is definitely, that's a vibe. That's a, you know, learning that your friends think that you might be some sort of inhuman robot. These are things you learn. The key difficulty I have with priorities is there are two ways to play. One of them, the default way, which is how we ended up playing and we almost immediately regretted it, was that every card that is exactly in the right rank, you get to score. Every card that is not in exactly the right rank, you don't get to score. So say for the sake of argument, I rank something 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the table ranks it 1, 3, 2, 4, 5. So pretty close. You just inverted two things. Well, guess what? That means you score 1 out of 5. The rest are off. And so, well, that's kind of weird. And on top of that, the way you score cards is that every card has a letter on it, and you try to spell priorities faster than the non-score pile of scores priorities. The alternative way is you just score points based on the proximity of your answer to what their actual ranking was. So if you're one off, you don't have that problem. It was okay. I mean, I think I prefer it to fun facts because the topics do actually lead to slightly more interesting discussion insofar as they don't all have to be numerical in nature. Instead of weird circumlocutions that fun facts resorts to, like, for example, if we wanted to evaluate somebody's feelings with respect to checklists, fun facts would say, on a scale of 1 to 100, how much do you like checklists? Which is kind of stupid. But yes, you put checklists up on a slate with, say, body hair.
Or and, kittens.
Or kittens, and you start wondering, oh, okay, well, I mean, obviously kittens win over checklists, but, well, I am allergic. Anyway, I guess it depends on the kitten.
There you go.
Can the kitten do a checklist?
I don't know.
Are kittens on the checklist?
Or kittens the checklist themselves?
We're gonna have to follow up on this.
Yeah.
So priorities is fine. Eh.
Yeah, I didn't mind it. You get 5 cards. One person writes down the order in which they want to. Everyone else has to try to put it into the right order. We have another game coming that's sort of like that. So maybe that one will be better. We'll see.
Further news as to party association games. Played 2 more sessions of Word Traveler by Thomas Dagenet L'Espérance, published by Office Dog. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. And I'm really souring on Word Traveler by virtue of the problems that I had with it last time. Namely, you can accidentally score more points than you're aiming to score. And indeed, that happened to me one of those rounds. I scored more points because people went off in weird directions. Parenthetically, this is not the fault of Word Traveler. But I was consistently amazed at Louis' thought processes. I was utterly unable to parse how he would issue priorities. For example, you could put 4 clues onto a certain direction, and he'd point to a building and say, ah, striking is one of the clues. That has some striking architecture. And then someone else might point out, yes, but that matches one of the 4 words. The other 3 words don't apply at all. And he'll say, that's true. It is striking architecture, though. I think we should go with that one. But it matches one of the 4 words. What about the other 3 words? Like, yeah, but it's striking. I feel good about that one. Endless repeat. Another example was, in comparison between a lucky cat figurine and a ginkgo leaf, he points to the figurine and say, well, they're not particularly mechanical. So one of the clues was not mechanical. It's a figurine. It's not very mechanical. As compared to a ginkgo leaf? Utterly wild. Some of these were clues that I gave. Some of them weren't clues that I gave.
And the cats very oftenly are waving.
I know. So very I know. That at least I will grant him that he might not be familiar with the automatically waving lucky cats.
True.
But anyway, setting all that aside, that is not the fault of Word Traveler. But in Word Traveler, on a couple of rounds, we just picked up a whole bunch of points by accident. Because that's the way the scoring works. What you get from Word Traveler that you wouldn't get out of, say, something along the lines of Codename Pixtures, is number one, it's purely cooperative, which I do kind of prefer. It's more flexible for player count. But you also get a strange kind of spatial freedom about what direction to go to follow a map card. But what you lose is a certain degree of difficulty, because we've gotten very nearly the highest possible score, very much like A Message from the Stars. But on top of that, just these accidental points, you might think that it would be more like the problem in priorities, where a single error leads you to a concatenating series of disasters because your second waypoint was wrong. So there's no chance you're going to get to where you want to by the 5th direction, because it's all premised on that first wrong inference. But there are points all over the board. So you just stumble up over them. I find it desperately unsatisfying.
Like I said, I think we should get some markers out, and we'll put some black squares on those map tiles, and you hit those ones and you're out.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't see why Word Traveler can compete with something like even just One. I mean, yes, You're not doing exactly the same thing because, again, you're making word associations with pictures. If that's specifically your vibe, if that's really the way you want to do it, then yes, there's a paucity of games like that. There are tons of games that associate images with images in the Mysterium Celeste Dixit line, and there are tons of games that associate words with words. If you really want to associate words with pictures, I guess Word Traveler is a good choice. But past that, I just find the scoring unsatisfying. Yeah, giving clues and having friends try to make inferences based on those clues is fundamentally satisfying. And all these games leverage that fundamental area of satisfaction. It's just between the option of having one with a slightly more robust and less arbitrary scoring system or one with more, I will choose the one with less. It's not because I think that's the highest priority in a party game. It's just you don't have to make that sacrifice. And so ultimately, I find Word Traveler disappointing.
Word Traveler.
On the topic of disappointing, I tried Cascadito. Cascadito is a roll-and-write game by Reiner Knizia. It was crowdfunded at the same time as Cascadero. Has nominally the same, I guess you would charitably call it a theme. Yes, Knizia designing themeless games is enough of a trope that it leads into caricature, but sometimes it is true. Some of the mechanisms are kind of informed by some notion of theme, but really, it only works as hard as you want it to work. And Cascadito has a lot of your standard roll and write trappings. Namely, you just push up tracks based on color matching. Not a whole lot of player interaction. No possibility of blocking. It has a little bit more player interaction than none because you're drafting dice. So there's something on a couple of occasions. I did look over and see what my opponents needed and figured, well, it makes no never mind to me. So I guess I'll take the one that they might want. And then they frequently got where they wanted to go anyway, but...
Spoils that I was contemplating this today, whether that Reiner Knizia has boiled down this roll and write genre to what Cascadero is. More, we'll talk about that later.
Sure,
right, takes away this randomness of the dice. So maybe he just threw that game. It's this is what roll and writes are, right? See this randomness and how the dice are painful, and it's just all about tracks and nothingness. And then, and now you're gonna play a real game.
Well, what's strange is that Reiner Knizia, in a very real way, is the hipster of roll and writes. He was doing roll and writes in the late 90s and the early aughts before Welcome 2 was ever conceived. You know, the Take It Easy games and all that other stuff. And he's been doing similar versions of dice games. He's even designed roll and writes that aren't really roll and writes, but in point of fact, auction games that look like roll and writes. I'm thinking specifically about Medici, the roll and write, and some other things. It's bizarre. It's like it's almost marketing now for him. I don't get it. Anyway, Cascadito is very much like a traditional roll and write in that it's pretty abstracted, not really any player interaction, pretty pointless. I didn't really see the appeal, but it was quick at least, and there is some variation. There are four possible maps. They are slightly different, but at the end of the day, not particularly different. Anyway, Cascadito, Reiner Knizia, published by Bitewing Games. It's small. It's small and it's
widow.
It's widow and it's quick. But that's really all that there is to recommend it, I'd say. So those are the games we played last week. Now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. So, Barony is one of your favorite games, Walker.
It is.
I'm sure you saw this as well. Would you like to tell us about Barony?
Well, Marc-André is the designer, and Grail Games is now working on a new edition of Barony. Barony that came out in 2015. I love Barony. This is going to have new art, and it's going to include the expansion, Sorcery, and it's going to be on crowdfunding. So, if you never played Barony, this might be a good way to get in.
Other reprint news, Splatter is going to be reprinting Indonesia. As they've been doing of late, they did this in the past with their various editions of Antiquity. They are going to be fiddling with the components a bit. This time they're going to be changing the map and changing the wooden components. Indonesia is probably my least favorite Splatter other than Horseless Carriage. I don't dislike it strongly. It just leans a little bit more into the let's build some chaining infrastructure borderline pick up and deliver vibes in a way that I don't quite like. But it, like every other Splatter game, is a wonder of lots of gameplay options with relatively few rules and very, very good at what it does. So if you're at all inclined towards giving Indonesia a try, you'll have another chance because in addition to being very, very expensive, Indonesia for the past few years has been very heavily out of print. So I'm always in favor of more Splatter games in the market. I think Splatter has a very excellent niche and I am in favor of them getting lots of success.
Uwe Rosenberg is putting out a new game. It's going to be co-designed with Tito Lorenz and Friedelinspiel going to be publishing it. And it's called Black Forest. So it looks very interesting.
Schwarzwald.
Yeah, just so. Polish publisher, Born Dice. Apparently they have this, when I was reading it, it's like, oh, they have this whole side quest line. I've never heard of any of them. But anyway, they're putting out a Frostpunk game. So it's going to be like sort of a pared down version of the giant solo or cooperative game that is Frostpunk. This will be a much smaller, compact type Frostpunk game.
I would hope so. It's hard to get much bigger.
Speaking of small and compact, Buttonshy is putting out a Walking Dead game. It's called Walking Dead Surrounded. So if you're into zombie games and Buttonshy games, this will be for you. We like Aquatica. Aquatica is going to have a new expansion called Coral Reefs. More is always better with Aquatica. We liked Oathsworn. The people of Oathsworn are putting out a new game. This is called Avalon, The Riven Veil. Who knows? Will it be as good as Oathsworn?
It would be difficult, but I can hope.
And lastly for me is there was a Warhammer 40K video game called Darktide. And now they're going to get a miniature game. And it looks promising. It looks like there's a lot more to it than what we've seen Games Workshop, you know, come out with lately in their board game things. Like, oh, here's a map with some squares and some dice. It's a board game that you will buy to get the miniatures and pull them out and sell the rest. This looks like there's actually some teeth to it. So I'm looking forward to looking into this more. Darktide, the miniature game.
Other reprint news, Dungeon Twister by Christophe Bélanger is going to have a 20th anniversary edition. It is going to have built in the Paladin and Dragons expansion, as well as the 3 and 4 players expansion. These are the first two expansions from the original line of Dungeon Twister. I'm a little bit disappointed that they decided to go this route. I personally think that they ought to have expanded on Dungeon Twister 2, the prison. I thought I just liked the mix of characters more there. And I also think that the 3 and 4 player expansion is a waste of time because playing this 2-player game multiplayer is one of the all-time perennial classics of no. I've done it a couple times. It was a painful, painful slog and had all of the multiplayer problems you might associate with original 2-player games. So I do not recommend that. And, I mean, another thing they could have done is actually reprinted some of the hyper-obscure character expansions that were originally only published in French. And while I'm definitely not going to be recommending that every publisher publish every game in a massive $200 edition, I think they could have included a bunch more characters without too much expense because it's mostly just a couple of cardboard standees and call it a day. But alas, that might have foreclosed their ability to publish more expansions later. I like Dungeon Twister. It's really interesting and clever. And I like the works of Christophe Bélanger, and I'm hoping that a lot more of his work gets more attention. Finally, the Golden Geek Award winners have been announced. And I would encourage you to go to Board Game Geek and check all the winners. Congratulations to all of them. But a number of awards have been given to Sky Team, of which we're a big fan. Best Party Game went to That's Not a Hat, so congratulations to Casper Lapp on that one. And Best War Game went to David Thompson's Undaunted Battle of Britain, which delights me on two bases. Number one, David Thompson deserves a lot of recognition for his work. And number two, I'm sure all the historical wargamers are in a tizzy that a game like Undaunted Battle of Britain once again has won Best War Game. But by this point, I'm sure they're used to it. And I also congratulations to the winner of Best Podcast, to One Stop Co-op Shop. I would teach you the secret handshake into the Golden Geek speakeasy, but sadly, I was ejected for repeatedly loudly insisting on Yoo-hoo-based cocktails, so they've changed the security codes, so I can't welcome you in.
I'm trying to get you back in, man, I promise.
You keep saying that, and yet I keep seeing you laughing at me from inside. So, that is the news and why it doesn't matter. We will now take a brief break to pay some bills. It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be in the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. This week's episode is sponsored by Incogni. Every time I've been to a bank in the past year, I've overheard someone ask if a recent phishing email or text or other message they've received was actually been from their bank. I get it. These scammers have powerful tools at their disposal, thanks to data brokers that traffic in your private information without your knowledge. The good news is that you have access to tools, too. Incogni is a service that automatically removes your private data from the brokers that are all too happy to sell your privacy away as though you were the product. And since these data brokers can scrape your data again without your permission, Incogni will keep getting that data removed as many times as it takes while you have a subscription. Ever since I signed up with Incogni, I've had a drastic decrease in the number of robocalls, spam emails, and other scams from people trying to spoof email addresses of my friends and family. So try Incogni now. Use code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames to get an exclusive 60% off an annual Incogni plan. That's code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames. And we're back. On to our feature game, Cascadero. Cascadero was designed by Reiner Knizia, published by Bitewing Games pursuant to successful crowdfunding. Reiner Knizia is definitely a man who has designed games. I will focus on specifically his tile-laying games because Cascadero is fundamentally a tile-laying game. In the span of, and every time I look at these numbers and this story, I cannot believe it, between 1997 and 1999... Reiner Knizia designed and had published Tigers Euphrates, Samurai, Through the Desert, and Stevenson's Rocket. Oh my goodness, Walker. I would also point out that many years later, Blue Lagoon was published in 2018, which is also an excellent tile-laying game. And to this lineage, Cascadero aspires to join. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Cascadero?
He plays a horsey.
There you go. You place a horsey.
All right, now if this horsey is adjacent to a town and is part of a unique group of at least two or more and was not already adjacent to that town, the town scores. Now, if this group is the only thing adjacent, you move up the track once. But if something was already adjacent to the town, it moves up twice.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
That's it. If the Herald was next to the town, you move up again. Then the tracks, combo, 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 combo. Then you check if you've accomplished any of the achievements, then the next player goes.
So here's the fundamental thing about tiling games as far as I'm concerned. I very much enjoy tiling games, but only of a certain kind. At that point, past that kind, it can be very much hit or miss. And the emphasis that I like is when tiling is all operating on the same space. Lots of tiling games have you build your own little corner of the world. And sometimes I enjoy those games a great deal. Gods Love Dinosaurs is an example. You're building your own little biome. My biome is not going to abut your biome, and that's fine. But where possible, I very much like that we're all playing on the same board. And those four tile-laying games that I mentioned up top that Reiner Knizia designed, you're all playing on the same board. But the trick is, the reason why I like it that way is because two reasons mostly. One of them is that you get to deal with an evolving geography of the board. And so the board state changes, and as it does, your incentives change and your pressures change. Cascadero has that. It's the case that as things get blocked off, it's more difficult for you to satisfy some of the chivos. More on that later. But then there's the other part, which is the direct player interaction. Lots of games have what I would call, I'm not being rigorous here, don't hold me to these terminology, indirect player interaction. I took that card because I wanted it. You wanted it too, but that's not why I took it. I took it for me, and you get disappointed because you wanted it for you too. Then there's the direct competition where it's like, ooh, I could cut you off if I do that. That's part of my incentive structure. And it may even be my chief incentive structure some of the time, or at least part of it other times. And in those other board games that I identified, Tigers and Freddy's, Samurai, Through the Desert, Stevenson's Rocket, Blue Lagoon, you're doing that a lot. In Cascadero, not so much.
No, not so much. The board will evolve where you are cut out of some parts of the map. But there's very few times do you purposely place in order to stop someone from doing something.
Because it's almost never in your interest.
Yeah, it's always better. You know, there's always a better move for you.
Yeah.
Right? Because almost every placement gets you points and starts a combo chain. Whereas normally blocking, that's usually all it does.
Right. And I would quibble just a bit. Not so much gives you points, but lets you advance on a track.
Correct.
Gives you something, which may or may not be points. It may be other things. I agree. And the reason why I'm harping on about this and trying to explain the distinction is because there is player interaction in Cascadero, and usually in a game that looks like Cascadero and works out like Cascadero, there's going to be lots of blocking and competition for spaces and so forth. Not really in Cascadero. The incentive structure actually is such that in many ways you're better to draft off someone else's actions, but that doesn't inform the first player's action. Again, as Walker identified, if I'm scoring a city and somebody else has already touched that city, I get to score that city somewhat better than I would have otherwise. Is that a reason for someone else to avoid it? Does that inform their decisions at all? Not at all. It's just part of the evolving geography of the board. So yeah, I get to deal with a changing board state. That's good.
Yeah, because once you wait for someone else to touch a city, then they're going to wait for you to, you know, it's like a back and forth thing. It's not as though it's always going to benefit one player.
Exactly. But again, these are just incidental to the calculus of every individual player. I am dealing with a board state that evolves. Its evolution and the process of its evolution may be transparent to me, but my decisions are not driven by what board state I am leaving for other players the overwhelming majority of the time. And in this way, I find it frustrating when compared to other games that are very, very similar to it. Among them, many games by Reiner Knizia. To stress, I enjoy Cascadero enough. It's okay. It's pretty good. But the extent to which it is inferior to its cousins designed by Reiner Knizia, I find borderline painful in comparison, which is a strange kind of criticism. It's like, oh, you're not brilliant, but here we are.
For me, it compares most to Babylonia, in my opinion. It's the same sort of thing. You're placing, you're creating chains, you're blocking parts of the map off. You're not really
fair enough
blocking like full scoring opportunities out, but you're just sort of like the map slowly locks down on itself.
Fair enough. I will give Cascadero this over Babylonia. I think I prefer Cascadero over Babylonia, though I'm not sure. Babylonia, I found the scoring just desperately unsatisfying. There were never any big turns. You were just incrementally scoring here, there, and everywhere. It made it feel unsatisfying the same way that Steffenfeld scoring is often unsatisfying. At least in Cascadero, you get to have big turns. Now, it's the kind of big turn that I don't really like because everyone else is sitting around waiting for you to get on with it. And it's this strange kind of concatenating series of, okay, this lets me go up a track. Okay, this lets me go up this other track. This lets me go place another horsey. I place another horsey. Okay, I'm going up this track now. Points. Now I get a seal. Okay. And it's weird. There's not a whole lot of downtime in Cascadero. So when there is, it feels more painful than it should.
It's true. And so I mentioned achievements earlier, and there's sort of two big blocks of achievements. There's a block that everyone gets to do. That's just like connecting two towns that are the same color. And then there's the only one player block of achievements. And that's like, you know, connecting five cities of different colors or, you know, a bunch of different things. Moving up the track. If you move up the tracks well, then you get track points.
Yep.
More track points.
It's true.
And so there is competition for that part where only one person gets to do those.
That is true.
And then I find the end of the game very interesting as well, because either you're placing out all your horses or it's when someone hits 50 points, the game ends as well. So in a way it's a race, because a lot of times we've had people hitting big turns right near the end and just someone just got their one turn earlier. And I find that evolves very interestingly as well.
I actually think that the objective system, the achievement system, is one of my biggest gripes with Cascadero, because it makes almost every game feel the same. Because we don't have this same level of direct player interaction that you might have in other tile layers, and the fact that you're always competing for the same sets of objectives, I always feel like I'm just ending up doing the same thing. Maybe I'll connect to the two pink cities before I connect to the two white cities. Maybe sometimes I'll go crazy and then Cascadero will connect to the two orange cities before I connect to the two blue cities.
Yeah, because
this is what we call variety.
Yeah, because there's no race for it, right? That it doesn't really matter. And lots of times it's like, oh, I happen to connect that and there's room for everybody. It's like, so I'll just take those points now.
Yeah.
You know, you put the flag out and it's like, yeah, I did that two turns ago, but you know, whatever.
Yes. The competitive achievements I find are better than the non-competitive achievements, but even then the fact that they're always the same, again, contributes a little bit to the sense of sameness.
Which is odd, right? Because it's just the simplicity of getting a tile that you place over top and, you know, having different achievements, right? Which is, I can't see why they didn't.
I don't. So, well, that's just it. So this is very much still in Reiner Knizia's design idiom. One of the things that was mentioned during the crowdfunding was that this is Reiner Knizia playing around with tracks. This isn't the first time he's done it. In fact, the way that the tracks work remind me a little bit of Lost Cities the Board Game / Celtis, which is a game I prefer for what it's worth. I like the card play in Lost Cities and in Keltis more than I like the tile placement, how it works in Cascadero. But he doesn't tend to work in tracks very much. It's not core to the way he designs things. But I don't know that the system, and this is not a criticism or a compliment, I don't know that the system has enough moving parts or enough constituent elements to start messing around with the achievements that much. I think, if anything, if you tried to institute other achievements, it would make the game feel even more scripted than it already does. And so I just think it's a natural outcome of the fundamental way that Cascadero was structured and the way the points work. And it's just, I can't, especially returning to Through the Desert, which I keep meaning to do more often than I do, every game feels very different from each other, despite the fact that the scoring in Through the Desert, if anything, is simpler than the scoring in Cascadero. Most everything in Through the Desert is simpler than Cascadero. Of course, Through the Desert is simpler than most games. Some games you're going to push hard and make big enclosures. Sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes you're going to have a whole bunch of evenly spaced caravans. Sometimes you won't. Sometimes you're going to try to really blow out the point majority for the caravan. Sometimes you won't, et cetera, et cetera. Like, these are elements of texture that are informed by who blocks you, how they block you, what other people are pushing for, etc. Whereas every time I play Cascadero, it's like, all right, I've got my checklist. Let's avoid physical contact and go through the checklist.
Yeah, there's very few. Like, there was one time in that last game we just played as well. Mark is right beside this point scoring thing. And so if I move beside it, that will force his hand to take those 3 points.
Right.
And it's just like, well, then he'll just get the 3 points.
Yeah.
Which you know,
yeah, pressure moves like that make sense all the time in Through the Desert, exactly. In Tigris and Euphrates, in Samurai, all these other excellent tile lane games. You can do that, and it makes sense for you. There are incentives you can pursue, and you can engage in pressure plays. In Cascadero, it's all purely deterministic. You're only placing one horsey, that's part of it. And indeed, I remember exactly the situation. It's like, okay, well, where am I being pressured? Absolutely nowhere. All right, go through the checklist then. It's just... I don't get that sensation when playing other tiling games.
So back a little bit to the tracks. There is one interesting part about the tracks, and there's these forbidden spaces. So it's sort of like a dead zone that you can't stop in. So as you're moving up, so you have to move at least 2 spaces. So it leads to the sort of an interesting sort of break point where it's like, oh, I can move 3 up the pink track, but that will waste some of the movement. So I got to figure out how to move 1 up the pink track first and then do the big move. So I skip over that forbidden space and you know, do it properly. I thought that was interesting.
I agree. I also think there are 2 more interesting elements with the tracks. Number 1, there are the 4 player colors, and then there's white. White is different from the other player color tracks in that it is arguably just more remunerative.
Well, it's education, you see, Mark. Yeah.
And education, apparently the Cascadero cared a great deal about education. He wanted to get his learn on, as it were.
Is that Cascadero spoke back speak?
Okay. Yeah, precisely. And so that's interesting. The other interesting element is that in order to win, as a precondition for victory, you need to have maxed out the track of your color. So I playing yellow, need to max out the yellow track. Walker playing purple needs to max out the purple track. It's not quite as trivial as, you know, we constantly go back to the track in Gugong. In order to win in Gugong, you need to be on the track, but everyone gets to the end of the track without too much effort. It's a little bit more difficult than that. On a couple of games, I felt like I could push the end game, but I'm not nearly high enough on my yellow track yet, so I'd better wait. So that was interesting. I liked that part, and it made the incentive structure different for different players based on the map. But again, it didn't lead to an interesting kind of on-the-map competition. It was just an interesting texture for when you want to push for points.
Yeah, another thing on the track where you need to move a certain number of spaces are there's these seals littered along the track, and they're good for 2 reasons. 1, there's an achievement for having 3 seals that you haven't used yet, and used seals let you like score towns without worrying about having a group next to it. And sometimes that can be very handy.
Absolutely. It's strange. I feel like the tracks and the overall dynamic of how they work is more interesting than the actual game. Normally, I hate tracks because they're the least interesting part of a game. It's just this weird tacked-on thing where you're just climbing up a track and getting random resources or weird bennies that feel disconnected both thematically and mechanically from what you're actually doing. This is true in Silken. This among the trackiest of tracks. I felt that way about various permutations of Terra Mystica, etc., etc. But here in Cascadero, Canizio's like, oh, okay, well, let's play around with tracks. And I feel he made the tracks very interesting in a number of crucial ways. But the rest of the game falls flat to a large extent. It's a strange feeling.
So there are two games that come in the box. And it sort of, and it ties in because I want to talk about the heralds, and the two game types really reflect on how the heralds change the game state as well. So on one side of the map, you're placing it with horses, and there's these heralds that are going to move around to the different cities.
Or stay static based on which variant you're playing.
We always play with the advanced variant. I would suggest playing that way because it made gameplay very interesting.
More dynamic.
Dynamic. So you score the city that has the herald. It gets you extra movement on the track, and then you have to move that herald to a city that's close by. So it leads to these interesting combos where I'm going to place to go up this track, move the herald, and because I moved up on that track, it lets me play another horse, which I now place next to the place where I just put the herald. And so these interesting combos where you're sort of stepping along the towns, moving this herald, and you know, advancing on the tracks better. And there's only two heralds on the board, so someone could come in and steal it and move it, you know, away. You have to move it to a close city, but can still move it in a way that you can't get to it. Whereas the other side of the map, you're putting out all these farmer tiles, and they straight up replace towns. So that's going to reduce a lot of things and make it harder for a lot of things, i.e. a lot of the achievements where, you know, you're chaining cities together now, chaining towns together. A lot of those towns are now gone, so that's a little harder. And the heralds, you can't use the advanced variant with that, so you can only move the heralds if you move onto the farmer tiles that say move a herald. So big changes in how the game's played.
Yeah, I very much enjoy the added pressure. And in point of fact, the condition of having to max out your own color track I felt was more difficult in the farmer variant. And I appreciated that. It leaned into the design elements of Cascadero that I found engaging and interesting. And so I preferred the farmer variant. The farmer tiles themselves are just, you know, whatever. They're not they're not effects that are not repeated elsewhere in the tracks. It just, but surely by virtue of how it changed the geography of the board, I appreciated it.
Yeah, and how it really cut down on how the bonuses of the heralds.
That too. Another thing I want to mention about Cascadero, I've mentioned it before in the context of Allplay's publication of Through the Desert, is that I really appreciate how they tried to keep the form factor as compact as possible. This is, again, a small box game that could have easily been a Ticket to Ride size box game, but they kept it slim. It is no bigger than it needs to be to fit the board and the pieces. And it's got, I think, pretty good Ian O'Toole art. So I think it looks nice on a shelf. It's unobtrusive on a shelf. Nice small box. I approve.
Yep, and it's very easy to teach because, like we said, you place a horse. That's what you do in your turn. You know,
sorry, what was that? I lost you in the upkeep phase.
You place a horsey. So yes, that's all you're doing. It leads to a whole bunch of other stuff, but in the end, that is all you're doing. You're placing a horse, and the setup for the standard game is very easy. You just put cubes on the bottom of the tracks, and if you're playing the other side, you do have to put a bunch of farm tiles, but very easily to do. Plays quickly. I will play it anytime. I don't think I'll ever choose to play it. Solely because how Mark already talked about, the rest of Reiner Knizia games are just better.
Yes.
Specifically the tile laying games.
Absolutely the tile laying games. Part of me, this caused me to reflect back on many of the elements that I really, really appreciate about other Reiner Knizia tile laying games. And I'm very much out of step with a number of other people because I think, broadly speaking, the hobbyist gamer community reacted much more favorably to Babylonia than I did and much less favorably to Blue Lagoon than I did. And so part of me was thinking, it's like, would I really rather play Blue Lagoon over Cascadero? And I started thinking about it. It's like, yes, absolutely. One of the reasons is Blue Lagoon has that blocking in a way that Cascadero doesn't have. That's a personal preference.
And the super pressure. Like they're forcing the play of other players.
Yes. And on top of that, Blue Lagoon has that wonderful two-act structure whereby you place out your villages in the first round and all your various discs, and then you remove them all and you start again. And so you have a strategic horizon on top of the tactical horizon, and there's a dynamism that Cascadero just flatly doesn't have. And this dynamism, this element of pressure, of evolving, of reacting to a changing board state, this is the hallmark to me of a top-tier Euro tile-laying game, and it exists in spades in so much of other places in Reiner Knizia's catalog that is just not repeated in Cascadero. How could you make a tile-laying game where you're all playing on the same board with relatively constrained geography and make it feel so much like multiplayer solitaire? It's almost amazing.
Well, this is what I'm getting back to. Is this his take on what he feels Roll and Write is, right? Mm. It's this solitaire going up tracks, combo, combo, combo,
yep,
with no real pressure.
Yeah. It's really a shame because, as I say, I like what was done with the tracks, but that's kind of damning with faint praise because generally I don't approve of tracks. And Cascadero could have been, you know, another fabulous Reiner Knizia tiling game, because even though I'm not huge into Babylonia, it's still a very good design. And I have to say, despite the fact that I don't strongly dislike it, I'm sounding mostly negative because I am, but most of this is in comparison.
Yes.
Cascadero's okay. Just, I can think of half a dozen other Reiner Knizia games that I'd rather play.
Exactly.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, I don't know why you would, but if you would, you can find all our contact information on sowronggames.com. We read everything you send us. We'll get back to you if we can. I apologize. I'm a little bit behind on correspondence. Dear patrons, please, a little bit of patience. I'm going to be trying to crawl out of the mountain of over 2 emails this week. Thank you very much for your forbearance. Thank you for deciding to spend some time with us. We hope to see you again soon. Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoeseteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.